Everybody have one of the handouts? Okay. I'm doing something a little different today, as you can see. I'm doing something which is comprehensive, which goes back to the first book of Kings, and in fact, early chapters in the first book of Kings. And the trigger for this for me was in today's reading with Hezekiah, chapter, so 2 Kings 18. We read, in the third year, Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. Remember, Ahaz, you can see that also as Ahaz, A-C-H-A-Z. He was 25 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that David his father had done. All of a sudden, it just struck me. It isn't every king that gets identified this way. There are a couple of kings that get identified as being like David. Then there are a couple of kings that are identified where the author goes out of his way to say that they're not like David. Is there any kind of pattern to this? Not all bad kings are labeled as not like David. The good kings, they generally are. Although there are some kings who get kind of partial credit, but they are still not called like David. So what's the pattern? Why is it that there are kings that are labeled as, that are singled out as like David? Why are there kings that are singled out as not like David? And so I went all the way back, you know, to the beginning. Now, these two things are not on your sheet because they're background, but let me just explain what that is. If you look in the first book of Kings, the reason I start with 8 is this is where the temple is, as temple is, has been built and is now being dedicated. And remember that in the dedication of this temple, this is what David wanted to do, but was unable to do in his lifetime, and was unable to do because he was a man of war. In other words, he lived in a time of civil war, of instability, of friction with the surrounding tribes, the Moabites and Ammonites, and so on. So what Solomon inherits is, you know, peace and stability, and so that's what allows Solomon to complete what it is that David had intended in the first place. Okay, so when Solomon dedicates the temple, in a way he is finishing his father's work. Okay, and very plainly, what he is doing is connected to what his father wanted. So, insofar as he's doing that, he's not labeled as a king like David. He doesn't have that, but plainly, that's what he's aspiring to. Plainly, that's what he's aspiring to. I am finishing my father's dedication to this task. This was the thing that he wanted, that he was not able to effect. When you look in 11, this is where things start to go astray. Okay? And when David is mentioned, let's see, 11:4. When Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart after other gods. His heart was not wholly true to the Lord, as was the heart of David his father. So that's when you start getting, this is the first time you get this, you know, not like David his father. So that's 11:4. I don't think I put that on that sheet. So that's a new one. Okay? And it's particular with regard to worship. So, as you hear next, Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. and did not wholly follow the Lord as David had done. Okay, that's where you first get this. And as you continue, you start to see a pattern in terms of what these later kings, when they're with David or with not David, with regard to the temple. Okay, so what's been established here, that this is the king that built the temple, this is the way in which he was like David, and that now he falls away, that he apostatizes. There isn't something that happens in Solomon's time, it happens later. But whenever you have a king that's flagged as not like David his father, something happens to the temple. It isn't just unbelief. Because all the bad kings are unbelieving kings, or have problems or limitations with their belief. But wherever there's this identification of not being like David, something happens to the temple. The temple is involved in some way. So if you look at Jeroboam, and when you're reading it, you can miss it because the identification of his not being like David happens after the business with the temple. So start with you're told in 14. This is after he has set up this alternate place of worship, remember, and he is told by God that the kingdom will, I've taken the kingdom away from David and given it to you. But you have not been as my servant David, who kept my commandments and followed me all his heart, doing that which was pleasing in my sight. So Jeroboam is being told, he's the first king after Solomon, you are not like David my servant. And why? If you look at earlier, verse 12, which is the verse after this, he's the one who institutes this alternate place of worship. Why? If this people go up and offer sacrifices of the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, the heart of this people will turn to Rehoboam, the king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to him. Okay? So he is the first king to set up some official place in competition with the temple, deliberately to stop people from going to the temple. So that's the, if you like, the kind of the second indicator that to be like David is to be centered on the temple, to care about the temple, to have reverence to the temple. And when Jeroboam is being told that he is not like David, it's because he has set up this place that is a rival to the temple. You'll notice that I have Abias and Rehoboam together because this is father and son. One is identified as not being like David, and the other one has the temple damaged. So it's in the time of, at the beginning of 1 Kings, Abias, who is the son of Rehoboam, you're told that his heart was not like that of David, his father. But you have to kind of carry with it because you're told that just previously, he walked in the sins of his father. In other words, Rehoboam is bad and Abias is bad in the same way. Okay, and what happens during the reign of Rehoboam? In verse 14:25, in the fifth year of the reign of Rehoboam, Sesach, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the king's treasure and carry all off, as also the shields of gold which Solomon had made. So I think last time, I had talked about the king of Judah, or sorry, the king of Israel, remember laying siege to Jerusalem and violating the temple. And that's the first violation of the temple in 2 Kings, but it's not the first violation of the temple in this chronicle. The first violation is right here during the reign of Rehoboam, that as he has failed, he and his and now his son have failed up to live to David, now the temple becomes vulnerable. The temple is violated. Okay? So in that case, it's not the same king, but they're linked by this verse in which you're told that Abias is just like his father and that not like David. Okay? So Rehoboam is somebody who is not like David and in which then the temple is attacked. In that same chapter, later in that same chapter, when we have Asa, we are told that Asa did what was right in the sight of the Lord as David his father. 4 verses later, he brought in the things which his father had dedicated, as he had vowed, into the house of the Lord, silver and gold and vessels. So in other words, he's returning things or restoring things to the temple that had been taken. Okay? He is acting for the good of the temple. He is now repairing it. Okay. So that's 1 Kings. Turn the page. So now we're into 2 Kings, and now we're talking about some of the folks that we've been hearing about recently. Amasias in 2 Kings 14. We're told that he did that which was right before the Lord, but yet not like David his father. Okay, so this is a kind of a partial credit king, but he's still not doing what he needs to do. And what happens 9 verses later? Joash, the king of Israel, took all the gold, the silver, and all the vessels that were found in the house of the Lord, in the king's treasures and hostages, and returned to Samaria. When you are singled out as not being like David, there's some way in which you've left the temple vulnerable or you violated it yourself. Okay, Ahaz is the one we should spend a little time on, this fellow, because we didn't get to, I think, do adequate time last time. You're told at the beginning of chapter 16, he did not that which was pleasing in the sight of the Lord as David his father. Should have bolded that, as David his father. Okay, and if you look at 2 Kings 16, this is the fellow, starting in verse 10, that lays siege to a place in Syria, sees the kind of altars that the Assyrians are using, says, that looks great, I got to have one of those. Verse 10, when King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, he saw the altar that was at Damascus. He sent to Uriah, the priest, a model of the altar and its pattern, exact in the details. Uriah builds the altar. The king arrives from Damascus, views it, draws near, burnt his burnt offering, cereal offering, poured the drink offering. So we're getting this detailed description of how it is that this guy not only has the audacity to, right, admire this altar from afar, but wants it installed in his own temple and then goes through the procedure of worshiping before it. But not only do we have that, we have him actually doing, altering, or what can you say? I mean, really almost vandalizing the temple with regard to some of the fixtures. So, for example, what is described as the, if you go down to verse 17, Ahaz cut off the frames of the stands, removed the laver from them, and took down the sea from off the bronze oxen that were on it, and put it upon a pediment of stone. So, I don't know if you still have your, I wonder if I still have it. I had, yes, it's in here. Karen, I still have your lovely pictures of the temple here. So I don't know if you can see back there, but if you have these, the thing that he's talking about is in the temple precincts, there was this big kind of pool of water that was kept on these oxen, on these golden oxen, or gold-covered oxen, they would be pure gold. But so what Ahaz is doing is he gets rid of all those animals, just plop, puts this bronze sea on the floor. So these things that had been designed by Solomon and executed with reverence to his father's plan, you know, Ahaz has put in this foreign altar and worshipped in front of it, and now he's just sort of taking things out and moving them around. Okay, so Ahaz, of course, comes to a bad end. But this is, you know, this is again especially somebody who is irreverent to the temple or opens the temple to vulnerability. They get the not like David his father line. Yep.
What's cereal? When you cereal offering. Yeah, cereal offering.
Oh, grains. So that your Karen, do you want to?
Well, it is grains. However, it's viewed as an inferior sacrifice to God than blood, because
yep.
blood is what.
The blood is the life is in the blood.
Yes. And so to give God, and that's what God, Cain and Abel,
yep.
in trouble, is one was offering a grain offering, the other one was offering a blood sacrifice. And even when God covered Adam and Eve, he killed, they were trying to cover themselves up with leaves which fade and crumble. And so he sacrifices, it's the first blood sacrifice, where he covers them with a
skins,
cover,
yeah.
skin
yep.
from an animal. So going all the way back to Adam and Eve, blood is superior to grains.
Yep.
So he's,
remember, this is what's picked up by St. Paul. There is no remission of sin without the shedding of blood. And that's the thing, I think, for modern sensibilities that we find so hard. You know, think of how many people don't think of the Mass as a sacrifice. That the very term, the sacrifice of the Mass, is foreign to them. So they'll describe it as a memorial of the Last Supper. Right? Congratulations, you're a Calvinist. That's not what the Mass is. It may be in the form of the Last Supper, but it's only because the Last Supper anticipates the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. That is a bloody sacrifice. And the Mass is an unbloody representation of that same sacrifice. But why is it that Christ had to die? Okay? There are all sorts of ways that God could have saved us. But the argument of the letter to the Hebrews is that this is the fulfillment of which the sacrifices in the Old Testament were a kind of a build-up and a pattern. You know, so that the blood is in the life, that there's a way in which the old life is old life is passing away and a new life is taking its place. So you can't, the image doesn't work as well with grain, I guess, you know. I mean, it's true that unless the seed die, you know, that the plant won't be born. You know, you can do that much. But for the kind of image, you know, that gets you to death, but that doesn't get you the image of the punishment and the suffering that's due to sin. And I think that's one of the things that's being conveyed in sacrifice, in a way, the pain and suffering that are due to sin. So that's why, to go back to your question, so that's why grain, this is a low grade sacrifice, I guess is the indicator here. Now the place where I had started, Hezekiah. He did that which is good before the Lord according to all that David his father had done. And it's quick. You can miss it. But remember, Ezekiah is the one who has to pony up some money to keep the Assyrians at bay. And you're told, at that time, Ezekiah broke the doors of the temple of the Lord and the plates of gold which he had fastened on them. So as an aside, you're told, he was trying to restore the temple, like Asa on the previous page. He was bringing back things. He had to remove them. But the fact that he was trying to restore it, that is like David. His focus is on the temple. And then finally, spoiler alert, good King Josias. We are going to get a good king, so this is, I guess, a good kind of spoiler. You know, you have so many bad ones after a while that... you're told in chapter 22, he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, walked in the ways of David his father, and three verses later, let it be given to the workmen by the overseers of the house of the Lord, and lot them to distribute it to those that work in the temple of the Lord to repair the temple. Okay, so what's the essential, if you like, legacy of David? Is to have a heart for the temple. And the reason, this is what it is I was explaining last time, the reason it's focused on the temple is because that is how God is making himself present on earth. That there is some kind of visible way. It isn't just purely interior. There's some kind of visible, experiential way that you are dedicated to God. There is some kind of visible, experiential way that you are that you are focused on the temple, and the honor and dignity that is due to the temple is to be like David. Is to be like David. That's the importance of the temple. I know there are people who, when they read the Old Testament, they just feel as though there's a kind of a lower bar operating here. In other words, what you expect for Christian sanctity, and then going back to the Old Testament, somehow it's like it's just enough that they're not worshiping idols, or it's just enough that they're not, you know, sacrificing their children, or it's just enough that they're not, you know, under some kind of spreading tree or in some kind of high place. But you have to, as it were, take the times or take the merits of these people on their own terms. This is a Bronze Age people. This is a Bronze Age people who were always either right next to idolatry or just trying to get out of it. And so that you have in David somebody who, remember, for all of his moral failings, for all of his failings, as it's singled out, in fact, in 1 Kings, the affair that he had with Bathsheba and then the engineering of the death of Uriah. This was somebody that in terms of idolatry, in terms of false gods, never went astray. You know, that is in the context of the time, that's like heroic sanctity. Okay? In the context of the time, that stands out. Okay? Remember, you can think of earlier people. Think of someone like Gideon, you know, way back in the book of Judges, where God is talking to him, and Gideon says, why aren't you saving us like you did in the old times? And God says, I will save you, I will work with you. By the way, the big statue that's to Baal in the front yard, could you knock that down for me? Okay? I mean, think about that for a moment. Here is somebody that God talks to him, he responds, his heart goes out to God, and he's got something right there that he's just sort of clueless about. I'm not going to remember his original name, but remember Gideon, his original name, he's named after Baal. Gideon is the name that he gets from God. I think a Baal Fagor or something like that. So he has this name that's a name after Baal. Remember all of these Carthaginian names like Hasdrubal and Hannibal? Those are all Phoenician names. They're all Canaanite names. They all go back to Baal. This is one of the disadvantages of growing up in a Baal culture, is you were always going to get that in your name. That is something that even though Gideon is trying to be open to the Lord, he's kind of clueless. So when you look at David, yes, David has these moral failings. Yes, he's described as a man of blood because of the warfare all during his reign. But this is somebody who never went astray in terms of having a prayer life, in terms of being dedicated to God. There's no idolatry. There are no images. I mean, he wasn't able to keep it up for his son. you look at the kind of field that he's in. You got to say he stands out. So there are ways in which he doesn't seem like an exemplar to us. Again, because of Bathsheba and because of other things. But when you look comparatively, this is somebody who's always dedicated to God. And his heart is for creating this place of worship for God, of bringing God out of the, you know, bringing the ark out of the tent and putting it into this temple, putting it in this permanent temple. You know, that is something that if you look at a lot of kings after them, that's not where they're at. Okay. I sent you well, let me pause there. Are there questions on this or comments you might have? Yeah.
Why are the names different that you put on the board versus what we're reading in the Bible?
Because different Bible translations have different spellings, and when I'm online, I'm always using the Douay Rheims, because the Douay Rheims is online. This is the revised Catholic Revised Standard. I don't think this is online. So I would copy this if it were online. Yeah. Sorry. But you're right, it is confusing. Because you'll see Hezekiah, you'll see Ezekiah. You'll see it with an H or not an H. So I put the verses there so you can you can see where it is. Oh no, yeah, don't try. No, don't even try. Don't even try. Yeah, go ahead.
The Hebrew letter for B or V is identical.
Yep.
The only thing that makes it different is a dagesh, which is the little
dot
in the middle. And so some people will say Ava or, you know, Abba. Well, it might be Avi, which is the V. Also, Greek has no H. I have a daughter named...
Well, yeah, it's an aspiration mark.
Yeah. Well, like my daughter's name in Hebrew is Shoshana. In Greek, it's Susanna.
Yeah, because you wouldn't be able to put... You can't put an S-H, yes.
So
yeah, in Greek.
Even
you're right.
That, if you're trying to translate Hebrew and you're trying to put it into like Greek, or if you misread what you think the letter is because it's missing the dot or it's not present there, you can have a world of hurt trying to translate this.
Yeah, so in other words, you're working from a language that has a different alphabet. And then, Karen's right, you're moving from one alphabet maybe now to the Greek alphabet, now to our, you know, Roman letter alphabet. So that just creates all sorts of problems in terms of standard spelling. Yeah. But maybe it's a consolation. Just, you know, you can read things from the 1800s where, you know, there's a lot of English didn't have standard spelling, you know, and that was the same language. So, you know, you have to have a lot of literacy to have standard spelling. And it took a while. Other questions or observations besides just the nightmare of trying to keep these kings straight? Go ahead.
This may be obvious to everyone else, but it just hit me. Is this to show, like, the bloodline of David all the way with all these kings, and that they, to compare it to, like, Peter and all, you know, that, okay, Christ then from the family of David. And then he appointed Peter as the head of the church and has all the priests and popes that stem from that, and that there's been...
I don't know that that's intentional.
It's not. Okay.
Well, also, you know, when I think about the popes...
That there's good popes and bad popes.
Yeah, but the early popes, you know, are all good popes, because in those days, you died with your boots on. You know, all the early popes are all martyrs. You know, to be a bishop of Rome meant you weren't going to have like a retirement or golden parachute or whatnot. You know, you were going to die as a martyr. In fact, it's for the first couple of centuries, you know, the popes almost all die violently. You know, when you think of bad popes, you tend to think of Renaissance. You know, whereas the sad thing that you see here is, you know, things go bad pretty quick. In other words, I hope the early papacy wouldn't look like this, because things go bad pretty quick here.
So more the fact to just prove, to show that when it comes to humans trying to continue God's work on earth, there's problems.
Sure, but again, I think the example that you have from the early church is really a pretty exemplary bunch. Not just popes, but bishops. I think of St. Basil. At one point, he was being threatened by the emperor for this and that, and he just refused, no, I'm not doing what you want me to do, or I'm not handing these things over that you want me to hand over. And the emperor said, I am not accustomed to being addressed in this fashion. And Basil said, well, I guess you're just not used to talking to a Catholic bishop. Again, because in those days, to be a bishop meant that you knew that you were signing up for possible martyrdom torture, exile. You were tough. That was just, now the joke, you know, the joke is, well, this is an Episcopalian joke, but my Episcopalian friend told me this. So at the consecration of an Episcopalian bishop, right, there, all the clergy are sort of around him like this. And apparently somebody whispers, what are they doing to him? And another person whispers back, they're removing his backbone. Yeah. And in an age of sort of comfort and peace and stability, sometimes your bishops become kind of people persons. In other words, they get to the episcopacy because they're great with people, or they're good administrators, or they're well liked, or those are not necessarily the kind of people that are great under persecution or difficulty, or they have a kind of affection for PR and getting along well. If you look at these early church fathers, like, you know, St. John Chrysostom, St. Basil, and Ignatius of Antioch, and so on, they're gritty. They're not the kind of people that you would sort of want on camera and passing out, you know, lollipops to babies or something like this. They're tough. And but that was the founder. That was what the church, you know, grew up under. That was how you got a church, because there were people who had that kind of leadership at a point in which the world was against you. I think that's always the hazard. I think for a lot of, not just for Catholics or Episcopalians, but for a lot of communions out there, in a way, the friendship of the world is more dangerous than the hatred of the world. You know, the hatred of the world, it's like, you know where you are. But the friendship of the world, you're always trying to get along, and you hope that if you just change this or change that or say it a little differently, they'll keep liking you. Remember Sally Field years ago at the Academy Awards? You like me. You really like me. It's like there are people in Christian leadership. They have this inner Sally Field, just hoping that they'll be liked. You have to remember that, especially like with cardinals. I mean, they wear red because that was a reminder that the early people in leadership shed their blood. And, you know, I don't know what happens over time. Do you just look at yourself, oh, I look good in red? I had friends in seminary who would talk about how it is that there's some seminarians that you can tell that they are really dreaming of the day they'll be bishops. And in seminary, they call it scarlet fever. Yeah. And I think it's St. Thomas says, and it's not original St. Thomas, he says, if you want to be a bishop, That's a very bad sign. That disqualifies you. You know, the only reason that you become a bishop is because you recognize that God is calling you to that. But nobody in their right mind should want to be a bishop. Not because like the time in your schedule or something or the pressure. It's that you are responsible for the souls of the people in which you govern. You're responsible. And you know, there are things you do or things that you fail to do. When that redounds to your people, that's on you. Nobody should want that responsibility unless they are called by God to it. You know, you aren't really like John, James and John. Can we sit on your right hand when you come into your kingdom? And what does Jesus tell? You don't know what you're asking. You really don't know it. There's an early indication of scarlet fever. So in 19, that's when Sennacherib invades, and it's verses 35 down to the end. I guess that's 37. And I pass this out to you because here's George Lord Byron. It could be once upon a time in high school or college. You had to read Byron as part of your unit on romantic poetry. And this is a different era, my friends. This is an era where even rebel, bohemian British poets write poems about scripture. Okay? And the reason I know about this poem is because of P.G. Woodhouse. You may or may not be familiar with P.G. Woodhouse. He's the one who wrote the Bertie and Jeeves stories, which were, they were turned into television on BBC about 20 years ago with Hugh Laurie. And the lines from this poem will always crop up in P.G. Woodhouse stories because P.G. Woodhouse belonged to a generation in which English schoolboys had to memorize poetry, and lots of poetry, and and it kept coming up over and over again, so it stuck with them. Even Bertie Wooster, who's just this bachelor wastrel, just self-indulgent, life is going nowhere, lines from Shelley and Byron and Wordsworth are always sort of rattling around up there for him, because that was simply part of his formation. So, how many are many of you familiar with this poem? Have you seen this before? So, just think of the end of chapter 19, as this angel appears, right, and this army struck down. The Assyrian came down like the wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold. The sheen of their spears were like stars on the sea when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. Like the leaves of the forest when summer is green, that host with their banners at sunset were seen. Like the leaves of the forest when autumn hath blown, that host on the morrow lay withered and strown. For the angel of death spread his wings on the blast and breathed in the face of the foe as he passed. The eyes of the sleepers waxed deadly and chill. Their hearts but once heaved and forever grew still. There lay the steed with his nostril all wide, but through it there rolled not the breath of his pride. And the foam of his gasping lay white on the turf, as cold as the spray on the rock-beating surf. And there laid a rider distorted and pale, the dew on his brow and the rust on his mail. The tents were all silent, the banners alone, the lances uplifted, the trumpet unblown. The widows of Asher were loud in their wail. The idols are broke in the temple of Baal. And the might of the Gentile, unsmote by the sword, hath melted like snow in the glance of the Lord. Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if, like, you know, American school children were memorizing this as opposed to, like, composing haikus and syncanes and all the things that they did in my generation? You know, I don't remember how many haikus I composed as a... Maybe they sound good in Japanese. I don't know about English. No, limericks were what... Those were the naughty things we told each other outside of school. Yeah. They didn't actually have us writing limericks, which probably was a very good idea.
At my school, we had to compose limericks. So.
Did you really? Okay.
That tells you my...
Very good. So...
I'm serious. That's funny.
The destruction of Sennacherib is a kind of a heartening moment in an otherwise sort of overwhelming narrative. But again, Hezekiah is we're going to see him kind of in trouble with Isaiah in the next chapter. But this is somebody who is really trying, who really is, you know, trying to follow God's path and really trying to do things the right way, and. When you give on your end, right, God is going to provide on his end. I'd recall you back to an incident I didn't get to talk about. Remember, as Elisha is dying, he tells the king, shoot arrows into the ground. And so the king does this, but he only does it three times. And Elisha is really disappointed with him. If you had shot the arrows, you know, 50 times would the Assyrians be defeated? In other words, what you see with that earlier king, that he was maybe you've heard this term before, pusillanimous. He was weak-souled or soft-souled. So here is the prophet giving him this opportunity to ask God to, you know, smash the enemy, and he just, oh, okay, how about this? Right? He can't really take what God is offering. But the lesson from Hezekiah is, like, the more that servant of God asks, the more that God is going to give. So it's in other words, there is this relationship between what you ask for and what you get. If if you just sort of, you know, expect the basics and the minimum, then, you know, that's what you get. Everything over and above that, you've got to ask. And if you think about Christian prayer, you know, that Jesus insists, you've got the kingdom of heaven is taken by violence. And what he means by that is that you are persistent in prayer and almost expect great things of what God is going to give you. And at the point where you don't, then it's not going to happen. You know, it's always going to be in response. God's never just going to wash his, I'm done with you. But he's certainly not going to give you all that you could have if you're weak in asking. That's a thing, that a pattern that you see over and over again, that you are firm in asking and you expect things of God's greatness. That's more likely to happen. Okay, so for next time, we will talk about 20 and 21. There's your understanding and application. See you next time.